Welcome back to Cogumentative, your favorite Times Live / Times Media podcast, in which we chat about all things cars. I'm your host, Thomas Faulkner from the Sunday Times and Times Live Motoring. And this week I'm joined in the virtual studio by my colleague Dennis Dropper from BD Motor News. Dennis, how are you?
I'm great, thanks Thomas, and nice to be back on the show. How are things on your side?
Yeah, pretty good. You know, we've had a public holiday this week, which has been a bit of a treat. You know, Heritage Day, get to celebrate things all South African. I was actually celebrating something German. I had a Porsche Cayman GT4 on test, so I basically spent most of the day roaring around Joburg doing things that are highly illegal.
So that was you, I heard.
Exactly. That was me. The car is going back on Saturday morning, which I'm actually quite glad about, because if I had it for any longer, I would probably end up in jail. So, it's been a short and explosive visit. And what a car. I know that you've had it before. We've chatted about it ad nauseum on this podcast. But when Porsche makes a Focus Cayman, they really make one well. It's been a pleasure to drive around it. But what's been happening on your side? Any interesting news or, cars in your driveway?
Well, from Porsche Cayman GT4s to something distinctly more humble, and Toyota South Africa this week unveiled its new Starlet hatchback. And this is basically a rebadged Suzuki Baleno, because Toyota and Suzuki have this international cooperation agreement. And it's a sub-B segment contender, which replaces the brand's popular but aging Etios in the battle against the VW Polo and Renault Sandero and a few other cars. It's a very attractive little vehicle, and in particular, the pricing is very competitive, because it starts at 204,900 Rand for the baseline Starlet 1.4, and that undercuts vehicles like the Polo, which starts at 244,000, and in fact, the Suzuki Baleno, on which it's based, which starts at 222,000. So, for somebody shopping in that segment of the market looking for maybe a first car or maybe even an empty nester car, it does seem like quite good value. It's got quite a lot of spec, a standard ABS and stability control, and at least two airbags. The higher models have four airbags. And of course, it's built by Toyota, which comes with the implication of good reliability.
It does indeed. And also a massive dealer network. Wherever you go in South Africa, there's a little Toyota dealership or a big one. So that's, added peace of mind. It should do well. People here love Toyotas. I think the Etios was getting very long in the tooth. It's never been the most, exciting of small cars. It's a bit frumpy. So the Starlet should do well. It's interesting, though, because Toyota just seems to be a company that's getting more and more into brand engineering. We've got the Supra, which is basically a Z4. We've got the 86, which, as we know, is a BRZ. And now we've got the Starlet, which is a Suzuki Baleno. So it's going to be interesting to see if people find umbrage in that, or, if it's going to, just be accepted. But I guess time will tell.
I think if it's got a Toyota badge and a good price tag, then it's already won more than half the battle.
Exactly. I agree. And Dennis, I don't know if you saw, earlier this week, BMW unleashing the new M4 and M3 models.
That's right, yeah. These have been drip-fed to us in a very long teaser campaign, and now finally the wraps have officially come off. And it's a very controversial style. The Twitter sphere is ablaze with comments on that large, gnashing vertical grille, which harks back to some older BMWs, like back in the day of the 328. Yeah, look, whatever you think of the grille, the engine behind it is certainly putting out some decent firepower. And the basic version makes 353 kilowatts. But being the petrol heads we are, we're not going to get the basic version. We are going to get the competition versions, which have 375 kilowatts and 650 newton meters worth of torque, which are going to pitch them basically more or less directly against the Mercedes C63 AMG. So that battle is set to recommence in the German sports sedan and sports coupe category.
Yeah, it looks like a monster. And as you said, I mean, South Africans, well, in South Africa, we're only going to get the competition versions, which means automatic only. You can get a manual in the base models, but those aren't coming here. But quite frankly, you know, with a car with that much power, I think automatic is the way to go. You know, having a manual, I think it just slows down the car and maybe detracts from the cornering performance. And yeah, but it's going to be coming out here in 2021, first half of the year, pricing yet to be confirmed. But yeah, it should be an exciting car to drive.
I wonder how long it'll take for people to find that frontal styling becomes the new normal. Because I know that when Audi first came out with its giant gaping grills, everyone was shocked and horrified. But now it's like, you know, it's just normal. So maybe the same will happen to these BMWs.
Maybe. You know, it's such a polarizing design feature. I don't know. I just can't get into it. To me, it just looks weird and awkward. Personally, I wouldn't be surprised if BMW changes it during that car's life cycle, you know, when it comes time for a facelift. But I don't know. Maybe people do enjoy it. Maybe it is going to catch on. Time will tell. But for me, I don't know. I prefer the look of the older grills. But having said that, I've always been a fan of the Bangle-style cars, you know, of the 2000s. And I think it was a sad day when Bangle left BMW. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. But leaving BMW, is there anything else that's been going on?
Well, I tested a very interesting gadget recently, and it's called the Garmin Catalyst. And this is a gadget that claims to improve your lap times. It's a 20,000 Rand device. It's about tablet-sized on the dashboard of your car, and it gives you real-time coaching. So, for instance, it'll after you've done a few laps, it'll stitch together what it believes is your ideal lap from your individual sector times. And then it'll tell you how to drive to achieve that lap. So it'll say, for instance, brake earlier for the next corner, or apex earlier or apex later, things like that. And I played with this device. Garmin hosted a day at Swartkops last week, and it was very interesting. From the coaching point of view, I felt that some of the instructions were possibly a little bit late, in that I was already kind of committed to a particular braking point or line through a corner by the time the instruction arrived. But what I did find was very helpful was it gave you a real lap timer, which showed you how much further or how your lap time was comparing to your best lap time. So it showed in green, for instance, if you were 2 or 3 tenths ahead, or in red if you were a little bit behind. So immediately you could see, like, okay, I fluffed that corner because now I'm in the red. But when you got things right in the next one, it put you back into the green. So, I only had about 12 laps to experience it, and I'd need to play with it a bit more. But from initial impressions, it seems like it could actually help some people improve their lap times. So maybe the next time you go racing, Thomas, you can loan one of those units and see how that works for you.
I'd actually love to give it a go, Dennis. I've been following it with interest, you know. They had a kind of like a pre-launch article, and obviously it was launched last week. So I'd be quite keen to give it a whirl. My teammate, actually, in Lotus Challenge, he's been umming and ahhing about maybe getting one. So it would be quite cool to get my hands on one and see if it helps him as well, because, you know, it's kind of quite hard to give people coaching in a single-seater. But yeah, I mean, it's not cheap. 20,000 Rand is quite a large amount to cough up. But if you're serious about improving your lap times and getting faster around the track, then maybe it is worthwhile.
Yeah, and nothing in motor racing is cheap. So I think in the context of that, then 20,000 Rand doesn't seem like much.
Exactly. It's the bottomless pit. The more you have, the more you'll spend. And that's just a cold, hard fact about motorsport. That's it, Dennis. We've got to move on. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to be joined in the studio by a special guest. So stay tuned for that one.
Join me, Nicole Engelbrecht, your host on True Crime South Africa, a weekly podcast that covers both solved and unsolved South African true crime cases.
Welcome back to Cargumentative. In this segment of the show, we're joined in the virtual studio by cars.co.za customer experience manager, Hannes Oersthuizen. Hannes, thanks so much for taking the time out to join us here. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I can't complain. You know, the sun is out. The rain is away. I think it's down in Cape Town because you said it's pouring down there.
Yeah, it's just started bucketing down.
Excellent. Well, it's a good excuse to stay indoors and open a bottle of red or a bottle of white, or maybe both, you know?
Sounds fantastic.
Now, Hannes, before we go on, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what your role is at cars.co.za?
Sure. Okay, so my title is Consumer Experience Manager, but I think that's going to change pretty soon because that's not really what I do day to day. I'm more involved in content strategy, so heading up the content team. Also, for Cars.co as a business, more strategic new projects. So, for example, the Cars.co Consumer Awards, for example, as well as the Sentimental project. So, very much a strategic content role for me at the moment.
Okay. And I mean, it's actually pretty interesting because, look, I mean, I've been in this game now for a while, since about 2008. And back in those days, you were at Car Magazine. That's where we first met. And then you were editor of Car for about 2 years. And then you also got a chance to sample things on the other side of the fence. You were in automotive PR. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, actually, after Car Magazine, you know, I felt that to have growth in my career and, you know, financially, professionally, everything, I needed to move out of media and into the motor industry itself. And I looked specifically for a brand that would give me as much exposure in as quick a time as possible. So if I joined one of the big brands, you would become like a product manager of, let's say, a specific model. And it would be quite limited. But I was fortunate enough to join GWM at that time. And I didn't only do PR, I did product planning, I did product pricing, I did marketing, events, I even did some dealership training. So very quick, very accelerated learning curve on what it's like on the other side of the fence. And I must say, a lot of what I learned at GWM has helped me a lot in sort of defining this role for myself at Cars.co and shaping the content that we do here.
And I mean, what was life like in PR? I mean, I think a lot of motoring journalists, you know, kind of think they might like to try it out. Was there a lot of culture shock?
I wouldn't call it culture shock, really. I think you look at the media landscape a lot more intently. You know, you track things, obviously, for your own purposes much better. And I think you learn a lot about the media industry when you're not in the media industry. You're actually observing the media industry from the other side. So I would say I got a lot of respect for guys, some of the smaller guys, what they're doing because of the things that we could track on our side. And it kind of opened my eyes to what the media landscape, you know, who the big players are and who the big players of the future are, really, in a very short space of time.
And I mean, you mentioned players of the future. Moving to cars.co.za, I mean, that was also quite an interesting kind of move to make because back in the day when cars.co.za came out, I think a lot of the established print media guys almost looked down their noses at it. You know, it was kind of like an online platform and, you know, it wasn't very big. But in a couple of years, it's now kind of grown and you guys have a massive online footprint. You have awards and you've got the Sentimental project as well. So, I mean, what do you attribute this massive growth, you know, from being a relatively obscure website to a large online media force?
So I really attribute it to the founders of the business, Ross McElroy and Alistair McMurray. They saw the need for content on Cars.co way before I joined, and they appointed David Taylor back in the day to run content before I joined. So the purpose of content really for us at Cars at Koza is really, you know, if you look at what we were as a classifieds and how people buy cars. So typically a person would buy a car once every 4 or 5 years. So if as a platform, you only speak to a person once every 4 or 5 years, then, you know, it's a very, what's the word, limited conversation, and the ability to sell advertising obviously diminishes with less traffic. So content really is there to perform a marketing role for us. Content is not necessarily monetized or doesn't need to be monetized directly with us. We believe that if we provide consumers with news, relevant news, consumer advice and entertainment, then, you know, wherever they are in the buying funnel, whether they just sort of just bought a car or whether they're going to buy a car in 4 years' time, if we can provide them with a reason to come to the website every day or at least once every week, you know, obviously it's to the benefit of the website's numbers, and then it's that's to the benefit of selling advertising, it's to the benefit of SEO. So content really performs multiple roles for us. And I think with awards specifically, what the goal was, certainly from my point of view, was we needed to gain a consumer authority role. And we needed to change the perception, as you correctly say, of Cars at Koza as purely a classified. So the Cars at Koza Consumer Awards is a very serious awards program. It's grown very fast, and I think it has changed perceptions, not only in the public's eye of what Cars at Koza is, but also in terms of the OEMs.
Okay. I've been hogging the mic. I'm going to pass it on to Dennis Dropper, my colleague from BD Motor News, who you obviously know fairly well. And maybe you guys can tell our listeners a little bit more about the Sentimental program, because that's quite a nice thing you guys have got going.
Yeah, hi, Hannes.
Hi, Dennis.
Thanks for joining us today. It's great to have you aboard. And yes, I would like to find out a little bit more about Sentimental. So can you just give us a little bit of background about exactly what it is you do, where you source your cars, what you do with them?
Sure. Look, the cars are only one part of Sentimental. I think I'm just going to take it back a little bit to why we do Sentimental in the first place. So, you know, if Cars at Koza's main business is helping people buy cars, it's a very, it's brain work, understand? You need to give facts, advice. And buying a car is never supposed to be a very, it's more of a rational process. And I think we've done that pretty well in the past few years. So we've become known as this consumer authority. But what we've also learned is that, you know, South Africans are petrol heads. And if we want to appeal to people, not just, you know, when they're buying a car, but to their hearts as well, then these really emotional cars, these can say it's almost like a passion project for Cars at Koza, but it's also a way in connecting with South Africa's enthusiasts, of which there are many. So we decided we need to produce content for these enthusiasts. And at the same time, we discovered that, you know, the more we dig into this South Africanness or the South African heritage of the automotive heritage, the more appealing it became to actually have some of these cars ourselves and do content on them and take them to events and so on. And so and that's how the whole collection started. We started with a Superboss ground up restoration. The car was found for us by the person who restored it and who is known as the Superboss restorer. And as that sort of gathered steam and we saw the appetite from our audience, we know we since acquired 4 more cars. One of which is a Ford Capri Piranha, which is sort of entering restoration at the moment.
Great stuff, Hannes. I believe that there's also a very nice Alpha in the fleet. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so as most people would know, in the 80s, in Group 1 racing, there was a fairly serious rivalry between the likes of BMW and Alpha and Ford, and Alfa Romeo did a local development called the GTV 6 3 liter, of which I think 212 were built. And so, of course, our collection exists entirely of South African specials. So we tracked one down. Also, the car that we bought from the owner who then restored it for us. So he was very passionate about the project. And in fact, for me, just to get the keys out of his hands to that car is a mission. He's really protective of it. But I would say that car and the process it's gone through is, it sets a new sort of high mark for us in terms of restorations. If there was a Concours South Africa this year, we would have definitely entered it. I believe it would have stood a very good chance of winning it. I've only driven it once for a few hundred meters because at the moment we are treating it as a display car because it is just in, I mean, you must just see this car underneath. It is immaculate. You can lick every part of that car and it would be dirtier afterward.
That sounds awesome. So now when these cars are not on display and not being driven, I mean, are they safely stashed away and lovingly buffed and polished and getting ready for the next competition? Or do some of them actually get driven?
So the cars are in Johannesburg, and obviously the content team is down in Cape Town. And for that reason, they're standing still most of the time. But I have embarked on a sort of a PR campaign with these cars, especially in this Heritage Month, to take the cars to the media, to get them to experience the cars and to drive them. When we started the project, we said that these are not going to be garage queens, and that certainly is not going to be the case. As soon as the Alphas won its trophy, it will become available in our PR fleet as well. But we are bringing some of the cars down to Cape Town, and then they'll be driven a fair bit more. We don't intend selling these cars. They're going to be part of our, let's say, the Cars at COSA heritage as well. We're a proudly South African company, and I think playing our role in protecting these cars is important as well.
Yes, for sure. I mean, South Africa has quite a rich history of SA-built specials. I mean, we're looking at other vehicles like the Ford Sierra XR8, the BMW 333i. Any plans to get those kind of vehicles onto your fleet?
Absolutely. You know, we've got five cars in our fleet at the moment, two E30, 325iSs as well, Evo 1 and the Evo 2, and as I said, the Capri Piranha. So Sierra XR8, BMW 333i, Sheferenza Can-Am, even BMW 745i. These are all cars that are on the hit list. But you know, the further you go down this rabbit hole, the more South African specials you discover.
Right.
There's the Fiat 131 Racing, which very few people know about. There's the Mini 1275 GTS, for example. So yeah, eventually it can become a fairly substantial collection if we want to go for every one of them.
Yes. And I mean, what kind of reaction do you get? I mean, are there a lot of old school petrol heads who still remember these cars from their heyday?
Definitely. I think our most successful videos, especially, and in terms of prints as well, you know, it's the cars from the 80s and early 90s. It's the people of sort of my age that are now looking back at Group N Racing, Westbank Modifieds, and really fondly remembering the cars of the 80s and the early 90s. So, and that's also the period where you had Group 1 and you had Group N. So, and that's the peak time of the SA special. So massive interest, even from overseas. You know, we sell prints of these cars on the Sentimental shop. And Octane magazine has picked up on it. We're shipping quite a lot of prints overseas at the moment. I've been asked to write a fairly definitive piece on South African specials for a overseas-based magazine. So I think, you know, there's this perception that South African specials were just sort of thrown together by the racing teams using bits that were available to them. But I think that's an inaccuracy that we need to address. And it's time that we accurately document and highlight the importance of these cars within our automotive heritage.
Well, I think you guys are doing a great job at keeping SA's auto heritage alive, and kudos to you for that.
Thank you. And it's fun as well.
Yeah, of course it's fun. Thomas, that's all from my side for now.
Cool, Dennis. Well, thanks a lot. Hannes, talking about South African specials, are you guys planning on ever getting a Daihatsu Materia Turbo? Because, I mean, I think we won that, you know, of the final South African specials ever made before, you know.
Is yours for sale?
I actually sold mine at the beginning of the year. Yeah, it's sold already.
Yeah, so we missed out.
You missed out, but I know the guy who bought it. He's a friend of mine. He lives in Durban. Yeah. It's still down there, kicking around.
Do you know how many they made?
I think they only made about 40. I think they made about 40, and there were about two or three mules which were apparently black. All the production variants that they sold were white. But it was
I'm a big Daihatsu fan, so I've owned two in my life. Well, I've bought them for my wife, but nevertheless, owned two Daihatsus. I believe in the brand. And I don't know if you remember, around about the same time, Kia had a Proceed hot hatch that was also exclusive to South Africa.
Jeez, so I don't actually remember that. I can remember going to the Proceed launch at Swartkops. So it must have come out just after the launch.
Yeah. So even, 2010, thereabouts, we still had some cars that were pretty special to this company. Mm.
But I guess it becomes harder and harder to do, because a lot of the companies are obviously, the headquarters are overseas and there's so much red tape, to go through these days that South African specials like that Proceed and like the Daihatsu Materia Turbo, it's going to be harder and harder to make those cars and actually bring them out to market.
Yeah, I think at most we can expect the addition of a little sticker at the end of a name, maybe a trim change or two. The era of the SA specials we'll never have that again.
It's sad. But I'm interested to hear that some of your cars are going to be available for the media to drive. I would be super keen to drive your Superbus. I saw it last year, actually. We are. I will cancel any new car, any new test car to drive a Superbus because they're so cool. I think they're just way cooler in looks and, performance than the Golf GTI. I've always been something of an Opel fan.
And I think appreciate this one because it's got that distinct Mentos smell, if you remember from Stain City.
I do, yeah. It's like one half Mentos, one half mothballs, one half 80s awesome. It's just such a cool car, so if we could make that happen, I would be a very happy man. I'll get in touch with you after the show and we can hopefully hook something up. But you were talking about cars from the 80s and 90s and you move in classic circles. In the past, we've seen cars like the Porsche 911 just go crazy in terms of market value and desirability. What do you think is going to be the next big thing in terms of cars and classic cars and collecting classic cars within the next couple of years? Is there any specific mark or genre that collectors are probably going to go crazy for?
Quite a difficult question in this lockdown COVID period. But based on what I've seen in the UK, it is really your 80s cars and your early 90s cars that the people of my age and a little bit older maybe really are throwing money at. So your E30s, your E36, the E30 is already gone to some extent, but your E36s are going to follow. Anything with an embed really is going to appreciate. But I guess you have to really look at things with limited build. So, cars like the BMW 1M already, perceived as a modern classic. And then also things like the Porsche Cayman R, limited build Porsche is always going to appreciate, or should, if the world was not upside down. Yeah, I think Honda S2000, although the Honda S2000's prices just never seemed to really go down. I think it's already probably bottomed.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually seen them go up. I mean, before you could buy a fairly decent S2000 for, around about 200,000. But now if you want a clean one, you're looking at 300,000 plus.
Yeah.
So they've already started to go up in value.
And then if you can find a clean, unmolested early Subaru Impreza GT or STI, even the Bug Eye, I think those might also be a good bet. But again, I mean, finding one is just quite problematic.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've long been a fan of the Bug Eye. I think it's one of the coolest Subarus. And I haven't seen one in ages. And if you do, they're normally, sort of modified with terrible wheels and aero kits and stuff. I think they just got to a stage where nobody really wanted them. It was the bastard child of the Impreza range, and they were going for a song, and people picked them up, drove them for a few years, and then couldn't afford the maintenance. And I totally agree with you. I mean, if you do find a nice clean one, then that's definitely a car to get.
And also, that's really been the story of the SA specials as well, is that so many of those cars, nobody would ever have imagined how valuable they would become. And even the E30 3-5 ASs, the Cadet Superbosses, you could pick those up less than 10 years ago for a song. And now you're talking big money, even for a super boss in pristine condition. So you never know.
Yeah, it's true.
Anything of limited build really has a good chance.
And tell me, what do you drive? I mean, what is your personal car when you're not driving test cars or your amazing fleet of sentimental South African specials? Do you have anything special in your driveway at the moment? I mean, I can remember you used to have an Opel. It was an Opel Manta, was it? GT, no, that's it. GT, yeah.
No, I know where the Opel GT is and I want it back desperately, but the owner doesn't want to budge. At the moment, I wouldn't say I'm dailying it. It would be a bit of a stretch, but I've got a 67 Citroen DS19, which, you know, I use for events and when the weather is good and when the battery is not flat.
That's a very cool car. I've actually never driven one. But just in terms of styling and the interior and the technology that was at the time, you know, just head and shoulders above most of its competitors.
Well, when you're in Cape Town, give me a shot. Come drive it.
I'd love to. I'd love to do that. What's that car like to maintain? I mean, you hear these horror stories about the suspension system and, you know, the pneumatics and all that kind of stuff going awry. Is that just, you know, urban myth or...
It depends. If you get a good one, like I've got, my car's had the same mechanics since it was sold new to now. It's something that you don't often get. So this person knows this car, you know, every nut and bolt of it and has serviced it from new. So I've got a good one. It's been the most reliable car, old car anyway, that I've ever had. Mechanically, she's very strong. It's probably a little bit of rust popping out now that I need to attend to, but that's usually the same story with all old cars. But if you buy a Citroen DS and it's not a good one, then you're in for a very bumpy ride, literally and financially.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, look, Hannes, it's been great chatting. I could keep on chatting old cars for hours, but producer Didi is waving her hands at me and saying we got to move on. So, once again, thanks for joining Dennis and myself on the show, and thanks for telling us about the Sentimental project. It's very cool. And to you listeners out there, if you want to go check it out, go to sentimental.shop and you can see all sorts of videos. There's some articles, I think, and you can obviously buy some of the prints that Hannes has been talking about. If you've got a man cave, I know that many of you do, some really cool stuff to put in it. So yeah, go have a look. And again, Hannes, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks from my side, too. Great to have you aboard today. Go well.
You too, Dennis. Take care.
And folks, that brings us to the end of the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed listening to Hannes and his insights and revisiting some of those amazing SA specials, which is, you know, all part of Heritage Month. So, yeah. But again, we'll be back next week for another episode of Cargumentative. Until then, keep it safe on the road and keep it wheel.